technology. That's working.
That's excellent.
Well, I have here with me Roy Sandbach, who's with Procter & Gamble. He works very much and has worked for a long time in the area of innovation, but with a rather interesting job title for an organisation who's very much about products. Roy's a research fellow. Roy, I wonder if you could perhaps begin by explaining what a research fellow is and what he does inside an organisation like P&G.
Yeah, sure. About 15 years ago, Procter & Gamble decided that it was appropriate to identify and provide an opportunity for them to continue to work. A group of people within research and development who had skills that were appropriate to innovation, but which would be reduced in impact, or indeed they wouldn't use them at all if they stayed within the research and development management community. As a consequence, P&G, like many companies, put in place a dual career track system within research and development. And at that time, I was offered the opportunity to stay as a working technologist, upstream product developer. I have a lot of interest in new product visions and prototyping. I was offered the opportunity to do that work rather than manage significant projects with a large number of people taking the project from establishment through to the marketplace. As a percentage, we are probably about 10 to 15% of the total R&D organisation in P&G. R&D is about 8,000 people, so that's about 800 in total. As a consequence of identifying those people, obviously, it was necessary for P&G to create a job content and a job structure which within which those people could flourish. Now, P&G didn't really do that. The individuals themselves started to do that, and I was one of them. And to all intents and purposes, my job structure is really quite straightforward. I work in a sense of client and supplier. My clients are the businesses, and I'm the supplier of innovative new product development thinking, whether it's chemistry, physics, design, or whatever. And I spend approximately 40% of my time working the biggest business issues that Procter & Gamble faces. Usually they're consumer-facing issues, but they can just as easily be technology-facing facing issues, or indeed market-facing issues. Another 40% of my time I apply to what I call stuff no one else does. There are quite a number of... I do a lot of detective work. I examine opportunities within the business unit I operate in to do new things, to challenge existing processes, to answer what-if questions. What-if questions like, what if in 5 years' time we were regulated out of oil-based surfactants? Mm-hmm. What would we do? You might think there are an awful lot of people who think about those questions in a large organization like Procter & Gamble. And there are some. But they don't always have the kind of connections that a research fellow might have. They don't always necessarily think as broadly as a research fellow might think. So I spend about 40% of my time doing stuff which no one else would do. And then finally, I spend about 20% of my time essentially teaching. Teaching the organization in the R&D organization in Procter & Gamble probably has an average age of less than 30, which is a remarkable thing, really. As a consequence, we've got to bridge from old knowledge to new knowledge as well as we can. And you can't just do that through a computer. You've often got to do it through people. And so as a consequence, I spend about 20% of my time doing that. So I'm a supplier of capability, in broad terms. I deal with some of the toughest product and consumer-related problems that Procter & Gamble has as a supplier of capability. I look for new things, and I teach. And I think I'm fairly typical of research fellows in the organisation. There are about, I'm not sure exactly how many there are, but there are about 100 altogether. Mm-hmm. There are relatively few in Europe, but just that's simply because the organisation is in America. I am a chemist by training. In fact, I did chemistry here at Imperial College. But over the past few years, I've become more and more interested in the boundaries between science, engineering, design, and art. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, it's my belief that the biggest innovations in product-orientated businesses happen at those boundaries. And I think I'll come on to that a little bit later.
I mean, that's very interesting, not least because it's an evolving job description, but it's also one that places emphasis on making connections inside a large organisation. We've heard a lot about Procter & Gamble and the new mantra of connect and develop. It's all very well to say open innovation, not all the smart guys work for us, we need to connect things up. That's the easy thing. How you actually make it happen seems to be the challenge. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how P&G is actually dealing with this on the ground.
Yeah, sure. I think as well, it's entirely possible to put in place a structure which we call Connect and Develop, which the academic world calls open innovation. But if you simply say to an organisation like the R&D organisation in Procter & Gamble, you will now do open innovation, then frankly, not a lot would change. Because whether we like it or not, large multinationals with a well-defined product range, with a need to support brands, they tend to have a bureaucracy which you know responds in a rather controlled manner. So the first step, I think, is to have a clear top-down direction that gives us some targets. We're big on targets. In fact, the clearer the targets, the more likely we are to concentrate the mind and put in place ways to achieve it. So several years ago, our chief executive officer, Mr. Laffley, essentially gave us a clear direction that we would achieve 50% of new ideas into the business from external sources. I think he gave us a time scale, but it was essentially do it quick, guys. Mm. The principle being that if we could bring the core competencies of Procter & Gamble to bear on any ideas, internal or external, then we would be able to make money. Mm. So he gave us that guidance. The second thing that that he did, and I think it's really important that this is shared throughout a product development or an innovation organization, is that he made absolutely sure that we all understood what Procter & Gamble is about. Mm. Now, it is a fact that in many organizations, the people at the working levels don't fully understand what their organization is really about. In the end, with P&G, it's about brand equity. It's about ensuring consumer satisfaction and superior consumer satisfaction. It's about delivering new product developments that create a very, very strong and sustained impression of the brands. It's the brands that count. And so as well as telling us what our task was, he and indeed the rest of the senior management made it very clear to us the context within which our task needed to be executed. Mm. So if we did go outside to look at new opportunities, we could almost always make a very early assessment of whether they were appropriate to Procter & Gamble or not, whether they fitted our business strategy. Yeah. And here, you know, you'd think that that would apply predominantly to the marketing community, or you know, but no, our whole R&D organization, in my opinion, is very clear on what we are about as a company. And so as a consequence, when we do fish and examine the pool of ideas that exist externally, or indeed internally, we make very early judgments on whether they're appropriate to Procter & Gamble's strategic direction. Even the junior managers in R&D have a fairly well-developed sense of what's right for us, which I think is good. And it's actually one of the reasons why we have, in the end, been successful. So it's putting in place a clear direction, and then ensuring that the people who are in the organisation looking for new things understand what they're looking for.
Yep.
And are not just wandering around saying, have you got something for us, guys?
Yes. Yeah.
I think the other thing is that we have in place a series of systems. Let me give you a couple of examples. Mm. One example is we have a series of internal organisations which are essentially communities of practice, with a special, each of which has a special focus on some cross-business technology area. So for example, it might be fabrics and fibres, it could be analytical chemistry, it could be organic chemistry, it could be packaging. And what this helps to do is to ensure that we have a connected process across business units. Mm-hmm. Many very large companies have business units which operate in a very siloed manner, and so we have a structure which attempts to avoid that. The other system we have is a system which we call technology entrepreneurs. We have about 80 people in the organization, which is not a small number, whose responsibility it is to identify where gaps are in our existing delivery of technology or delivery of product of product performance, and to actively search for ways to fill those gaps externally. So that's a second system. I'll give you another one. There are quite a number of technology broker organisations externally that we use quite a bit. Mm-hmm. We use people like Innocentive,
yeah.
People like Nine Sigma, mm-hmm. As ways in which to approach a very broad range of external potential problem solvers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just three. I mean, I could give you plenty more structures that relate
so
to the way
in
which
it's not
we
just
do it.
The words. There's actually a lot of structure and system underneath.
There's a top-down guidance on what we need to achieve. There's a significant understanding of the areas in which we need to play, and then there are some important internal systems which help us to do the connect and developing. So, now, I think you asked also about challenges.
Yes, yeah. I mean, just thinking about I think you said once Procter & Gamble's got some serious growth challenges.
Oh, sure.
Because it's such a large organisation.
Sure.
But in an environment which is extremely turbulent,
yeah.
How does it achieve that? Where are these innovation challenges?
Well, there are two challenges with respect to open innovation which remain. It's not rocket science, and they remain, in my opinion, work in progress. The first challenge is the big guy, little guy challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Many ideas, particularly disruptive ideas, will tend to come from sources which are small,
yeah.
compared to P&G. And we need to encourage those people to come to us with their ideas, and therefore we need to have a very sophisticated intellectual property plan, and we need to make sure that they come to us and talk to the people who they can feel comfortable with. So we do have a connect and develop organization, which is the first point of call for people with ideas that might be appropriate for our company. Nevertheless, you know, we've had examples, and we continue to have examples where our response can be slow because we're much bigger and more complex decision-making organization than many small companies. So as a consequence, they don't understand that necessarily. And then secondly, of course, we have the old issues of owning ideas and ensuring that that whoever comes to us is suitably protected and understands the risks that might exist for sharing ideas with people like us. That big guy, little guy issue, we are much, much better at now than we ever have been. And indeed, we've got some great examples. The Olay technology based on peptides essentially came from a small French company called Syngenta, who we saw first at a conference. And that by itself, I mean, 20 years ago, we would not have been at conferences. And we worked up that technology with them. We've worked with them extensively over the past few years. And they're a relatively small company. We're a very, very large company, but the relationship has been certainly successful enough to make a big difference to the Olay business. In addition, the spin brush example, the Crest spin brush example is quite a good one. Some entrepreneurs in the US came to us with the idea to put a small rotating motor into a into a toothbrush at relatively low cost, a perfect example of a disruptive innovation as defined by Christensen. And they indeed, some of them came to work inside Procter & Gamble for 18 months. So, you know, we've had, you know, essentially individual innovators coming to work inside P&G. Nevertheless, it remains work in progress. I think the second issue is particularly the case now in today's turbulent economic times, and that is that we are very, very careful about ensuring that the work that we do is well focused on the needs of the business. And that tends not to leave very many gaps for novelty. So if somebody comes with an idea to us which might require some exploratory work, it's sometimes even difficult to find time and energy and people and money to just do that little bit of exploratory work which would tell us whether the idea is a good one or not. I don't think there's an easy solution to that either. Very fortunately, the company has put in place a small amount of funding opportunity for research fellows like myself to go and ask for $25,000 to $100,000 of initial funding to examine new ideas. But it's not the easiest thing in the world to pick up, to find any slack in the system. I think that's the way to describe it. It's difficult to find slack in the system. So I think those are the two open innovation challenges which are most critical to Procter & Gamble looking ahead. By the way, we have over 50% of our recent business initiatives are externally.
Really? So you've actually exceeded the target?
I don't know the exact number, but I know it's of over 50%. If you read Mr. Laffey's book, you'll...
Oh, The Game Changer.
The Game Changer book. It's in there. So there is, you know, scope for real clarity on the big guy, little guy issue. And there is scope to enhance our opportunities to fit new idea exploratory work into our existing programs. they remain the two biggest open innovation challenges.
Well, I guess one last question then, really. P&G is an organisation which has been working hard for many, many years to innovate and continue to innovate.
Yeah.
And that comes through, as you've just described, updating, upgrading its capability.
Yeah.
If we think about managing innovation more generally,
yeah.
lessons for any kind of business, public or private sector
right.
even, what sorts of lessons, if I could ask you an impossible question, distill your experience, your wisdom, your understanding of the innovation management challenge as you've learned it in P&G, what sort of messages might come out?
Right. let me think about this. What I'm going to do, John, is I'm going to talk about two areas which you probably won't yet see addressed fully in the academic. If you were to pick up a book on managing innovation, then you'll read quite a lot of really, really useful stuff about putting in place structures for innovation, and to a degree, something about the climate for innovation. But there are two areas that I think organisations might want to ask themselves some questions on. The first one is, do we know what Lotka's law is?
Lotka's law?
Yes.
I don't, so...
Right, well, let me tell you that if you look at publications in the scientific literature, or indeed patents, or indeed almost anything which involves producing new stuff, you find that there is, for 100 publications, generally speaking, very, very few people have produced the majority of those publications. And often 20% of people produce 80% of the publications. It's the 80-20 law,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
Now, Lotka, in fact, did an analysis of that in the context of both publications and patents. And he found it was an inverse square law.
Mm.
Now, what that means in the area of innovation is that we really should examine whether in very large organisations there are just a few people who we could call serial innovators who consistently come up with significant game-changing ideas. I should say, by the way, that one of my preconceptions no one will convince me otherwise, is that that great ideas come from connections made inside an individual's head. Ideas can be developed by groups, but the original idea
that flash
comes in somebody's head through knowledge and connections. So the question is, in organisations, who are your serial innovators? Now, I don't think very many organisations have examined that question with any rigorousness. Many think that innovation is the job of everybody, and I am not sure about that. Many have no idea about Lotka's law and have never examined their innovative capability through the eyes of serial innovation. And I think that if we could do that, because those people need to be nurtured. And if you can't nurture them if you don't know who they are.
Yep.
You can't give them extra bits of money. You can't give them extra flexibility. Now, P&G has a technical career track which might be dealing with that. But it's inadvertently dealing with it. It's not knowingly dealing with it. So the question is, serial innovators, have you got any in your organisation? If you have, then what are you doing to nurture them?
Yeah.
The second area of innovation management challenge, I'm sure that you would know that being at the leading edge of this is critically important, is the question of multidisciplinary innovation. We are pretty much at the end of the road in many areas of product development with respect to the application of science by itself as a route to new product development. Companies which have depended almost exclusively on chemistry as the basis for new product development will in the future have to go in to other areas of technical development in order to deliver significant consumer improvements. Mm-hmm. That means working at the boundaries between, and I'll give you four areas, straightforward science, engineering, mm-hmm. and those two commonly do work together. Design, because I don't think people fully understand the power of design in the context mm-hmm. of new product development in any context, yeah. whether it's B2B or B2C, it doesn't mm-hmm. really matter. And thirdly, art, mm-hmm. Where the learning from artistic practitioners and mm-hmm. the enhancement of consumer and client response through artistic processes as opposed to scientific processes and straightforward functional performance, I think there are huge opportunities to build at the boundaries. Now, in order to build at the boundaries, you have to get scientists who understand design, you have to get designers who understand science, you've got to get the occasional artist mm. who is prepared to come and talk to Procter & Gamble, you've got to get scientists who go and sit in art schools occasionally mm. and read art books, or listen to the way in which music is responded to. But you've got to have people in multidisciplinary position, mental position, if you like. And I don't think we do that as well as we could. So serial innovators, who are they? And multidisciplinary innovators, do we have any? These are the two questions which are the source of, I think, major challenge for managing innovation.
It's absolutely fascinating, and in some ways it flags forward. It's not just connect and develop as it's experienced so far, it's actually pushing the frontiers of how we think about the innovation challenge.
Sure, it is, without question, in both those areas, you know.
Lovely, that's been really great. Thanks ever so much, Roy.
You're welcome, John.